Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the natural disaster in Japan that has led to an unnatural disaster of already catastrophic proportions, which, since it is still ongoing, the full extent of the nuclear threat to Japan, its people and its environment is still unknown. One of the nation's top experts on nuclear power, David Glockbaum, who was formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and is now director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, joins us. Then we will hear from Dan Hirsch, the president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, who studies issues of nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament. He will provide an additional perspective on the ongoing nuclear disaster, which some analysts are calling the worst in history, even more devastating than Chernobyl. Then finally, we will discuss the deepening tragedy in Libya, where, following the assessment of the Director of National Intelligence that Gaddafi will prevail, we will get an analysis of the Arab League's call for a no-fly zone and what is likely to follow from Dirk van der Walle, a Libyan expert at Dartmouth College. I'm speaking with David Glockbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the National Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Glockbaum.
Good morning, Ian. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. And the full extent of the disaster in Japan is yet to be known, obviously because it's an ongoing catastrophe. And I think, in fairness, the Japanese authorities have been less than forthcoming. Is that your feeling, that information is coming out in dribs and drabs?
It is coming out in dribs and drabs. I think it's also a reflection of the magnitude of the disaster they're facing. Most of the emergency response plans are structured to deal with one problem at one plant, and they're way beyond those assumptions and those realities. So they're struggling to keep up with a monumental disaster.
And at this point, what we know is that the there is one partial meltdown at one of the plants, and then now the Japan nuclear, two of the reactors at one of the plants, and now we're told that the Japanese Nuclear Energy Agency has declared a state of emergency at a second nuclear power facility at Onagawa after excessive radiation levels. So let's start with Fukushima. Number one, first of all, there was what looked like a hydrogen explosion, and now we're told that there's a partial meltdown.
Yeah, the pictures and the stories are pretty clear that there was an explosion inside the reactor building, outside the containment building, but in the building that surrounds the containment building, that blew the metal siding off the upper floors. It's not clear what damage that explosive force did to the equipment, safety equipment inside that building, but it certainly didn't help it any. We're hearing this fuel damage on that first reactor. It's been described as a partial meltdown. It's difficult to tell the extent of the damage at this point. Even the 1979 accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania took almost 4 years until they were able to drop a camera down inside the reactor vessel to get a bigger, better picture of what the extent of the damage there. So there's been fuel damage. The extent is still to be determined.
And what do you think happened? At this point, they're apparently pumping in seawater and boric acid. But my understanding was that they had the tsunami warning. I don't know whether they shut the reactor down, but initially they lost power for the pumps, and then to circulate the coolant. Then the emergency power came on, but then went off again, and then it's been off since then, and then they've had to run on the second backup, which is batteries.
Yeah, that's the timeline that we're hearing, that the earthquake itself basically caused the primary source of power for the plant's equipment, the electrical grid, to be taken away. The plant's backup for that was on-site emergency diesel generators that can automatically start up and provide power, not for the entire plant, but for the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor and take care of other safety needs. The tsunami arrived approximately an hour later and disabled the emergency diesel generators. So now your primary power source and your backup power source are no longer available. The third backup, or Plan C, is a bank of batteries, very large batteries, that provide power just for the very barest bones set of emergency equipment needed to cool the reactor. And that third backup kicked in, was doing its role of cooling the reactor, but the batteries are not huge. They're basically had enough capacity for about 8 hours of use, the assumption being that before the batteries get depleted, you've either recovered one of the emergency diesel generators or re-established the link with the electrical grid. Fortunately, this accident didn't follow that script, and the core on Unit 1 was not sufficiently cooled and apparently went into some level of fuel damage as a result.
And because of the buildup of hydrogen, and that led to an explosion that blew the roof off the containment.
Yeah, one of the byproducts of this type of fuel when it heats up is it tends to disassociate or cause, there's a chemical reaction between the metal tubes that contain the fuel pellets and the water, the steam that's flowing by them, and that produces hydrogen in pretty large quantities. It's not clear at the moment how the hydrogen got from the reactor vessel inside containment into the reactor building around that concrete structure, but it's pretty evident there was hydrogen did ignite in that building and cause some damage.
Again, I'm speaking with David Lochbaum, director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Formerly, he was with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I think what apparently is more worrying, though, is at reactor number 3. Because there is it burns a mixed oxide fuel, MOX, which contains considerable amount of plutonium. Now, what do we know about the partial meltdown there with reactor 3 at Fukushima?
Well, the latest we've heard is that the reactor core has been partially uncovered, so that the water has either boiled away and uncovered. Last number we heard was about half, the top half of the reactor core has been uncovered by water. We're not hearing much data yet on the extent of fuel damage that situation produced. Reactor cores can be uncovered for a short period of time, and just the steam that's boiling off below it and running past the fuel can prevent a partial meltdown. But you don't have an infinite period of time to enjoy that situation, so you have to restore the water or face the consequences. We heard that they were able to hook up a fire pump to get water into the reactor vessel and also were injecting seawater, as had been done on Unit 1. I haven't heard anything definitive yet on whether those efforts were successful in preventing fuel damage.
But it is the fuel rods do are MOX, right, which has a lot more plutonium than the other.
Right. The Unit 3 reactor core did contain, the number I heard was it 8 fuel assemblies that had a mixture of both uranium and plutonium in them. One of the consequences or one of the prices you pay for that is that if there is a fuel damage, the potency or the size or the nastiness of the radioactive cloud that comes out of that damaged fuel is worse than the radioactive cloud from just a uranium fuel. So it tends to make the consequences of a reactor accident worse than they'd otherwise be.
And at this point, there's an estimated 170,000 people that have been evacuated from the area. We don't know what is happening with the other area that was just announced where there's a second nuclear emergency has been declared. That's in Onagawa. Do you have any information on what's happening at this second nuclear facility?
What we're hearing there is that it's similar to the casualty that the first two reactors suffered, in that there wasn't sufficient or adequate core cooling or cooling for the reactor core, and as a result, the challenge of it overheating. It's seems to be occurring later than the first two, so I don't know. It's going down the same path, apparently, that the first two took. Maybe the workers will be successful in diverting it before it gets to the same destination. That, you know, that remains to be seen.
But the workers already at Fukushima, one would think that that is a pretty hostile environment, isn't it, in terms of exposure to radiation? When you're in close there, trying to cover the core or pump the seawater in, that does, obviously there's a lot, that requires manpower, right?
Yes, it does. Some of the workers had to go to places to make some alignments to make some of these things happen. Also, they did some venting in the recent past, and that takes workers going to into places to make that happen. And the hydrogen explosion itself, blew metal siding and across the site, and also did some damage within the building itself. We're hearing that there had been. We heard at least one fatality on Unit 1 and some injuries over the past 2 days.
And in Chernobyl, of course, we know that a lot of the firemen and the workers that were literally racing across and shoveling boron onto the burning core, some of them died, and they were all exposed. So I guess we don't have any idea of the extent to which how much exposure radiation is coming out of that, or how exposed that core is in Unit 1?
There have been accounts of high radiation levels in the Unit 1 control room and cesium and other radionuclides detected in the air outside the plant. From the published report so far, it doesn't sound like the exposure or the amount of radioactivity is as bad as it occurred at Chernobyl, but the situation is still ongoing. It's far from a finish line, good, bad, or indifferent. So it doesn't look like it's that bad yet, but it's still on a path that it could approach or exceed it.
And then the Unit 3, right next door on the same site, that has the potential of spewing plutonium into the air, which is far infinitely more dangerous than the radioactive particles that might be escaping it from Unit 1, and then we have to add to that the other accident at the Onagawa, which you say it's going down the same path. How far along that path, we don't know.
That's correct. They're still, because they're on that path, there's still time for workers to reestablish cooling and keep it from that destination. Obviously, we hope that they're successful in those efforts. Time will tell how successful or not their efforts have been.
And I guess this is where the rubber meets the road, right? In nuclear power, in terms of the potential for an accident, that if you get behind the curve, then it exponentially gets out of control. And in the case of Chernobyl, it was largely a man-made because they were fooling around with a backup system. They literally created that accident. I'm correct in that, right?
Yeah, they were actually testing a safety system to make the plant even less vulnerable to accidents. Mm-hmm. That test went horribly awry, and the safety test actually turned into a safety disaster.
Right.
It wasn't self-inflicted wound of monumental proportions.
But in this case, a natural disaster has led to this unnatural disaster, and the backup systems were overwhelmed by this kind of chain reaction of the tsunami that put out, even though they'd shut it off, the tsunami took out the emergency backup diesel generators, and then now they're relying on batteries, and now they're relying on seawater. God knows what's happening to all the contaminated water, but that, I guess, is really where the big unknown is: the environmental damage and the damage to the inhabitants of the area.
Yeah, it's there's a lot that's remaining to be figured out on this one. But they still, even the use of seawater, if they're successful in cooling the reactor core, that safety net comes at a price, because seawater is very corrosive to metal, and the safety equipment and other devices inside the containment building really aren't designed for exposure to seawater and its corrosive effects. So, their first priority is to cool the reactor core. So, they're instructed to use seawater if nothing else is available. But that in time, that seawater may start disabling some of the instrumentation and controls they're using to diagnose and react to situations in the containment. So they may have some problems. They already have some problems, but there's going to be many long days ahead for the people of Japan.
And just in the last few minutes, then, David Lochbaum, again, Director of Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. These are Westinghouse light water reactors, are they?
The Unit 1 and Unit 3 are actually General Electric.
General Electric, but they're basically...
I'm sorry.
Aren't they the scaled-up version of Rickover's original propulsion unit for the nuclear submarines? Is that the genesis of their design?
These are boiling water reactors, which were not really amenable for submarines that Rickover used, because boiling water reactors, as a submarine tilts upward, downward, and makes many of its other maneuvers underwater, the boiling water reactor isn't as conducive for that environment. So these are land-based reactors that were developed around the same time as the Rickover's engines, but they're a different design.
Well, that was the point I wanted to make, David, was that these are very early designs that I know at Los Alamos and other places they've developed much newer generations of nuclear reactors that have many more safety redundancy features built in. It just seems to me extraordinary that the oldest designs of civilian nuclear reactors are the ones that have proliferated around the world thanks to us, largely, right?
Yeah, we developed the technology. There are some other reactors around. The United Kingdom, for example, went to more gas-cooled reactors, and we went for light water reactors. All of ours are that way, and most of the reactors around the world kind of followed suit. But there are a few other designs around. But to be fair to the reactor designers or the age of the designers, being hit with an earthquake and then a fairly severe tsunami was just something that wasn't in the cards. Either one of those occurred, Fukushima, I'm not sure we'd be talking about the plant today, but when you get the 1-2 punch of a very severe earthquake followed about an hour later by a fairly large tsunami, that's tough for any reactor to handle.
But not unprecedented in Japan, given its history.
No, it's something in hindsight, we probably should have anticipated and taken more steps to protect against. The related lesson that we ought to learn from this is that third set of power, the batteries, were only sized to last for 8 hours, and then once, if you didn't get things fixed before the clock ran out, you were pretty much left with very few options or no options. We shouldn't put the operators and the workers in that such thin conditions that, after 8 hours, they're out of emergency equipment. That was a pretty tenuous assumption that's come up with tragic results here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here and giving us an analysis of what's actually happening here, as much as we can tell. I thank you, David Lochbaum.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Ian.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with David Lochbaum, who's the director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and he was formerly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a non-profit nuclear policy organization focusing on nuclear safety, waste disposal, proliferation, and disarmament.